and laughed. The damp of his skin soaked through the thin silk, but I didn't care. Minutes later, he mumbled something into my hair. What?
Too close, he repeated, moving back a bit. It was too damn close, Sassnach, and it scared me.
I glanced down at the dirk, lying forgotten on the floor. Scared? I've never seen anyone less scared in my life. You knew damned well I wouldn't do it.
Oh, that.
He grinned.
No, I didn't think you'd kill me, much as you might like to.
He sobered quickly.
No, it was, well, those women. What I felt like with them. I didn't want them. Truly not.
Yes, I know, I said, reaching for him. But he wasn't stopping there. He held back from me, looking troubled.
But the lusting, I suppose you'd call it, that was too close to what I feel sometimes for you. And, well, it doesn't seem right to me.
He turned away, rubbing at his hair with a linen towel, so that his voice came half muffled.
I always thought it would be a simple matter to lie with a woman, he said softly. And yet, I want to fall on my face at your feet and worship you.
He dropped the towel and reached out, taking me by the shoulders.
And still I want to force you to your knees before me and hold you there with my hands tangled in your hair and your mouth at my service. And I want both things at the same time, Sassnach.
He ran his hands up under my hair and gripped my face between them, hard.
I don't understand myself at all, Sassnach. Or maybe I do.
He released me and turned away. His face had long since dried, but he picked up the fallen towel and wiped the skin of his jaw with it over and over. The stubble made a faint rasping sound against the fine linen. His voice was still quiet, barely audible from a few feet away.
Such things. The knowledge of them, I mean. It came to me soon after... after Wentworth.
Wentworth, where he had given his soul to save my life and suffered the tortures of the damned in retrieving it.
I thought at the first that Jack Randall had stolen a bit of my soul, and then I knew it was worse than that. All of it was my own, and had been all along. It was only he'd shown it to me and made me know it for myself. That's what he did that I canna forgive, and may his own soul rot for it.
He lowered the towel and looked at me, face worn with the strains of the night, but eyes bright with urgency.
Claire, to feel the small bones of your neck beneath my hands, and that fine thin skin on your breast and your arms. Lord, you are my wife, whom I cherish, and I love with all my life. And still I want to kiss you hard enough to bruise your tender lips and see the marks of my fingers on your skin.
He dropped the towel. He raised his hands and held them trembling in the air before his face. Then very slowly brought them down to rest on my head as though in benediction.
I want to hold you like a kitten in my shirt, Modunia. And still I want to spread your thighs and plough ye like a rutting bull.
His fingers tightened in my hair.
I don't understand myself.
I pulled my head back, freeing myself, and took a half step backward. The blood seemed all to be on the surface of my skin, and a chill ran down my body at the brief separation. Do you think it's different for me? Do you think I don't feel the same? I demanded. That I don't sometimes want to bite you hard enough to taste blood, or claw you till you cry out. I reached out slowly to touch him. The skin of his breast was damp and warm. Only the nail of my forefinger touched him, just below the nipple. Lightly, barely touching, I drew the nail upward, downward, circling round, watching the tiny nub rise hard amid the curling ruddy hairs. The nail pressed slightly harder, sliding down, leaving a faint red streak on the fair skin of his chest. I was trembling all over by this time, but didn't turn away. "Sometimes I want to ride you like a wild horse and bring you to the taming. Did you know that?"
"I can do it."
"You know I can. Drag you over the edge and drain you to a gasping husk. I can drive you to the edge of collapse, and sometimes I delight in it, Jamie. I do. And yet, so often I want..." My voice broke suddenly, and I had to swallow hard before continuing. "I want to hold your head against my breast and cradle you like a child and comfort you to sleep." My eyes were so full of tears that I couldn't see his face clearly, couldn't see if he wept as well. His arms went tight around me, and the damp heat of him engulfed me like the breath of a monsoon.
"Claire, you do kill me, knife or no,"
he whispered, face buried in my hair. He bent and picked me up, carrying me to the bed. He sank to his knees, laying me amid the rumpled quilts.
"You'll lie with me now," he said quietly, "and I shall use you as I must. And if you'll have your revenge for it, then take it and welcome. For my soul is yours in all the black corners of it."
The skin of his shoulders was warm with the heat of the bath, but he shivered as with cold, as my hands travelled up to his neck and I pulled him down to me. And when I had at length taken my last revenge of him, I did cradle him, stroking back the roughened, half-dry locks. "And sometimes," I whispered to him, "I wish it could be you inside me, that I could take you into me and keep you safe always." His hand, large and warm, lifted slowly from the bed and cupped the small round swell of my belly, sheltering and caressing.
"You do, my own," he said. "You do."
I felt it for the first time while lying in bed the next morning, watching Jamie dress for the day. A tiny, fluttering sensation, at once entirely familiar and completely new. Jamie had his back turned to me as he wriggled into his knee-length shirt and stretched his arms, settling the folds of white linen across the breadth of his shoulders. I lay quite still, waiting, hoping for it to come again. It did. This time as a series of infinitesimal quick movements, like the bursting of bubbles rising to the surface of a carbonated liquid. I had a sudden memory of Coca-Cola, that odd, dark, fizzy American drink. I had tasted it once while having supper with an American colonel who served it as a delicacy, which it was in wartime. It came in thick, greenish bottles, smooth-ribbed and tapered, with a high-waisted nip to the glass, so that the bottle was roughly woman-shaped, with a rounded bulge just below the neck, swelling to a broader one farther down. I remembered how the millions of tiny bubbles had rushed into the narrow neck when the bottle was opened, smaller and finer than the bubbles of champagne, bursting joyous in the air. I laid one hand very gently on my abdomen, just above the womb. There it was. There was no sense of him, or her, as I had thought there might be, but there was certainly a sense of someone. I wondered whether perhaps babies had no gender, physical characteristics aside, until birth, when the act of exposure to the outside world set them forever as one or the other. "Jamie," I said. He was tying back his hair, gathering it into a thick handful at the base of his neck, and winding a leather lace about it. Head bent in the task, he looked up at me from under his brows and smiled.
"Awake, are you? It's early yet, Modunya. Go back to sleep for a bit."
I had been going to tell him, but something stopped me. He couldn't feel it, of course, not yet. It wasn't that I thought he wouldn't care, but there was something about that first awareness that seemed suddenly private. The second shared secret between me and the child. the first being our knowledge of its existence. Mine, a conscious knowing, the embryo's a simple being. The sharing of that knowledge linked as close as did the blood that passed through the both of us.
"Do you want me to braid your hair for you?" I asked.
When he went to the docks, sometimes he would ask me to plait his ruddy mane in a tight queue, proof against the tugging winds on deck and quay. He always teased that he would have it dipped in tar, as the sailors did, to solve the problem permanently. He shook his head and reached for his kilt.
"No, I'm going to call on His Highness Prince Charles today, and drafty as his house is, I think it will na be blowing my hair in my eyes."
He smiled at me, coming to stand by the bed. He saw my hand lying on my stomach and put his own lightly over it.
"Feeling all right, are you, Sassenach? The sickness is better."
"Much." The morning sickness had, in fact, abated, though waves of nausea still assailed me at odd moments. I found I couldn't bear the smell of frying tripe with onions, and had had to ban this popular dish from the servants' menu, since the smell crept from the basement kitchen like a ghost up the back stairs, to pop out at me unexpectedly when I opened the door of my sitting room.
"Good."
He raised my hand, and bent over to kiss my knuckles in farewell.
"Go back to sleep, Mordunya," he repeated.
He closed the door gently behind him, as though I were already sleeping, leaving me to the early morning silence of the chamber, with the small busy noises of the household safely barred by panelled oak. Squares of pale sunlight from the casement window lay bright on the opposite wall. It would be a beautiful day, I could tell, the spring air ripening with warmth, and the plum blossoms bursting pink and white and bee-rich in the gardens of Versailles. The courtiers would be outside in the gardens today, rejoicing in the weather as much as the barrowmen who wheeled their wares through the streets. So did I rejoice, alone and not alone, in my peaceful cocoon of warmth and quiet. "Hello," I said softly, one hand over the butterfly wings that beat inside me. Part 3. Malchance. Chapter 18. Rape in Paris. There was an explosion at the Royal Armoury near the beginning of May. I heard later that a careless porter had put down a torch in the wrong place, and a minute later, the largest assortment of gunpowder and firearms in Paris had gone up with a noise that startled the pigeons off Notre Dame. At work, in l'Hôpital des Anges, I didn't hear the explosion itself, but I certainly noticed the echoes. Though the hôpital was on the opposite side of the city from the armoury, there were sufficient victims of the explosion that a good many of them overflowed the other hospitals and were brought to us, mangled, burned, and moaning in the backs of wagons, or supported on pallets by friends who carried them through the streets. It was full dark before the last of the victims had been attended to, and the last bandage-swathed body laid gently down among the grubby, anonymous ranks of the hôpital's patients. I had dispatched Fergus home with word that I would be late when I saw the magnitude of the task awaiting the sisters of Des Anges. He had come back with Myrtle, and the two of them were lounging on the steps outside, waiting to escort us home. Mary and I emerged wearily from the double doors to find Myrtle demonstrating the art of knife-throwing to Fergus.
"Go on, then," he was saying, back turned to us. "Straight as you can on the count of three. One, two, three."
At three, Fergus bowled the large white onion he was holding, letting it bounce and hop over the uneven ground. Myrtle stood relaxed, arm drawn back at a negligent cock, dirk held by the tip between his fingers. As the onion spun past, his wrist flicked once, quick and sharp. Nothing else moved, not so much as a stir of his kilt, but the onion leapt sideways, transfixed by the dirk, and fell mortally wounded, rolling feebly in the dirt at his feet.
"Bravo, Mr. Myrtle," Mary called, smiling.
Startled, Murtagh turned, and I could see the flush rising on his lean cheeks in the light from the double doors behind us.
"Mm-hmm," he said.
"Sorry to take so long," I said apologetically. "It took rather a time to get everyone squared away."
"Och aye,"
the little clansman answered laconically. He turned to Fergus.
"We'll do best to find a coach, lad. It's late for the ladies to be walking."
"There aren't any here," Fergus said, shrugging. "I've been up and down the street for the last hour. Every spare coach in the cité has gone to the armoury. We might get something in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, though."
He pointed down the street at a dark, narrow gap between buildings that betrayed the presence of a passageway through to the next street.
"It's quick through there."
After a short, frowning pause for thought, Murtagh nodded agreement.
"All right, lad. Let's go, then."
It was cold in the alleyway, and I could see my breath in small white puffs, despite the moonless night. No matter how dark it got in Paris, there was always light somewhere. The glow of lamps and candles seeped through shutters and chinks in the walls of wooden buildings, and light pooled around the stalls of the street vendors, and scattered from the small horn and metal lanterns that swung from cart tails and coach trees. The next street was one of merchants, and here and there the proprietors of the various businesses had hung lanterns of pierced metal above their doors and shopyard entrances. Not content to rely upon the police to protect their property, often several businessmen would join together and hire a watchman to guard their premises at night. When I saw one such figure in front of the sailmaker's shop, sitting hunched in the shadows atop a pile of folded canvas, I nodded in response to his gruff,
"Bonsoir, monsieur, mesdames."
As we passed the sailmaker's shop, though, I heard a sudden cry of alarm from the watchman.
"Monsieur, madame!"
Murtagh swung round at once to meet the challenge, sword already hissing from its scabbard. Slower in my reflexes, I was only halfway turned as he stepped forward, and my eye caught the flicker of movement from the doorway behind him. The blow took Murtagh from behind before I could shout a warning, and he went sprawling face down in the street, arms and legs gone loose and nerveless, sword and dirk flying from his hands to clatter on the stones. I stooped quickly for the dirk as it slid past my foot, but a pair of hands seized my arms from behind.
"Take care of the man," ordered a voice behind me. "Quickly."
I wrenched at my captor's grip. The hands dropped to my wrists and twisted them sharply, making me cry out. There was a billow of white, ghost-like in the dim street, and the watchman bent over Murtagh's prone body, a length of white fabric trailing from his hands.
"Help!" I shrieked. "Leave him alone! Help! Brigands! Assassins! Help!"
"Be still!"
A quick clout over the ear made my head spin for a moment. When my eyes stopped watering, I could make out a long white sausage shape in the gutter. Murtagh, shrouded and neatly secured in a canvas sail bag. The false watchman was crouched over him. He rose, grinning, and I could see that he was masked, a dark strip of fabric extending from forehead to upper lip. A thin strip of light from the nearby chandlers fell across his body as he rose. In spite of the cold evening, he was wearing no more than a shirt that glowed momentarily emerald green in the passing light. A pair of breeches buckled at the knee, and what amazingly appeared to be silk hose and leather shoes, not the bare feet or sabots I had expected. Not ordinary bandits, then. I caught a quick glimpse of Mary at one side. One of the masked figures had her in a tight grip from behind, one arm clasped across her midriff, the other rummaging its way under her skirts like a burrowing animal. The one in front of me put a hand ingratiatingly behind my head and pulled me close. The mask covered him from forehead to upper lip, leaving his mouth free for obvious reasons. His tongue thrust into my mouth, tasting strongly of drink and onions. I gagged, bit it, and spat as it was removed. He cuffed me heavily, knocking me to my knees in the gutter. Mary's silver-buckled shoes were kicking dangerously near my nose, as the ruffian, holding her, unceremoniously yanked her skirt above her waist. There was a tearing of satin, and a loud screech from above as his fingers plunged between her struggling thighs.
A virgin. I've got a virgin, he crowed.
One of the men bowed mockingly to Mary.
Mademoiselle, my congratulations. Your husband will have cause to thank us on his wedding night, as he will encounter no awkward obstructions to hinder his pleasure. But we are selfless. We ask for no thanks for the performance of our duties. The doing of service is pleasure in itself.
If I had needed anything beyond the silk hose to tell me that our assailants were not street ruffians, this speech, greeted with howls of laughter, would have done it. Fitting names to the masked faces was something else again. The hands that grasped my arm to haul me to my feet were manicured, with a small beauty mark just above the fork of the thumb. I must remember that, I thought grimly. If they let us live afterward, it might be useful. Someone else grabbed my arms from behind, yanking them back so strongly that I cried out. The posture thus induced made my breasts stand out in the low-cut bodice, as though they were being offered on a platter. The man who seemed in charge of operations wore a loose shirt of some pale colour, decorated with darker spots, embroidery perhaps. It gave him an imprecise outline in the shadows, making it difficult to look at him closely. As he leaned forward and ran a finger appraisingly over the tops of my breasts, though, I could see the dark hair greased flat to his head and smell the heavy pomade. He had large ears, the better to hold up the strings of his mask.
"Do not worry yourself, madame," Spotted Shirt said. "We mean you no harm. We intend only to give you a little gentle exercise. Your husbands or fiancés need never know, and then we shall release you. First, you may honour us with your sweet lips, madame," he announced, stepping back and tugging at the lacings of his breeches. "Not that one," protested Green Shirt, pointing at me. "She bites." "Not if she wants to keep her teeth," replied his companion. "On your knees, madame, if you please."
He shoved down strongly on my shoulders, and I jerked back, stumbling. He grabbed me to keep me from getting away, and the full hood of my cloak fell back, freeing my hair. Pins loosened in the struggle, it fell over my shoulders, strands flying like banners in the night wind, blinding me as they whipped across my face. I staggered backward, pulling away from my assailant, shaking my head to clear my eyes. The street was dark, but I could see a few things in the faint gleam of lanterns through the shuttered shop windows, or in the glow of starlight that struck through the shadows to the street. Mary's silver shoe buckles caught the light, kicking. She was on her back, struggling, with one of the men on top of her, swearing as he fought to get his breeches down and to control her at the same time. There was the sound of tearing cloth, and his buttocks gleamed white in a shaft of light from a courtyard gate. Someone's arms seized me round the waist and dragged me backward, raising my feet off the ground. I scraped my heel down the length of his shin, and he squealed in outrage.
"Hold her," ordered Spotted Shirt, coming out of the shadows. "You hold her."
My captor thrust me unceremoniously into the arms of his friend, and the light from the courtyard shone into my eyes, temporarily blinding me.
"Mother of God!"
The hands clutching my arms slackened their grip, and I yanked loose to see Spotted Shirt, mouth hanging open in horrified amazement below the mask. He backed away from me, crossing himself as he went.
"In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti," he babbled, crossing and recrossing. "La Dame Blanche!" "La Dame Blanche!"
The man behind me echoed the cry in tones of terror. Spotted Shirt was still backing away, now making signs in the air which were considerably less Christian than the sign of the cross, but which presumably had the same intent. Pointing index and little fingers at me in the ancient horn sign against evil, he was working his way steadily down a list of spiritual authorities from the Trinity to powers on a considerably lower level, muttering the Latin names so fast that the syllables blurred together. I stood in the street, shaken and dazed, until a terrible shriek from the ground near my feet recalled me to my senses. Too occupied with his own business to pay any attention to matters above him, the man on top of Mary made a guttural sound of satisfaction, and began to move his hips rhythmically to the accompaniment of throat-tearing screams from Mary. Acting purely from instinct, I took a step toward them, drew back my leg, and kicked him as hard as I could in the ribs. The breath exploded from his lungs in a startled oof, and he rocked to one side. One of his friends darted forward and seized him by the arm, shouting urgently, "Up! Up! It's la Dame Blanche! Run!" Still sunk in the frenzy of rape, the man stared stupidly and tried to turn back to Mary, who was frantically writhing and twisting, trying to free the folds of her skirts from the weight that held her trapped. Both green shirt and spotted shirt were now pulling on her assailant's arms, and succeeded in getting him to his feet. His torn breeches drooped about his thighs, the blood-smeared rod of his erection trembling with mindless eagerness between the dangling shirt-tails. The clatter of running feet approaching seemed finally to rouse him. His two helpers, hearing the sound, dropped his arms and fled precipitately, leaving him to his fate. With a muffled curse, he made his way down the nearest alley, hopping and hobbling as he tried to yank his breeches up around his waist.
"Au secours! Au secours! Gendarme!"
A breathless voice was shouting down the alleyway for help, as its owner fumbled his way in our direction, stumbling over rubbish in the dark. I hardly thought a footpad or other miscreant would be staggering down an alleyway shouting for the gendarmerie, though in my present state of shock, almost nothing would have surprised me. I was surprised, though, when the black shape that flapped out of the alley proved to be Alexander Randall, swathed in black cape and slouch hat. He glanced wildly around the small cul-de-sac, from Murtaugh, masquerading as a bag of rubbish, to me, standing frozen and gasping against a wall, to the huddled shape of Mary, nearly invisible among the other shadows. He stood helpless for a moment, then whirled and clambered up the iron gate from which our assailants had emerged. From the top of this, he could just reach the lantern suspended from the rafter above. The light was a comfort. Pitiful as was the sight it revealed, at least it banished the lurking shadows that threatened at any moment to turn into new dangers. Mary was on her knees, curled into herself. Head buried in her arms, she was shaking in total silence. One shoe lay on its side on the cobbles, silver buckle winking in the swaying light of the lantern. Like a bird of ill omen, Alex swooped down beside her.
"Miss Hawkins, Mary... Miss Hawkins, are you all right?"
"Of all the damn fool questions," I said with some asperity as she moaned and shrank away from him. "Naturally she isn't all right. She's just been raped."
With considerable effort, I pried myself from the comforting wall at my back and started toward them, noting with clinical detachment that my knees were wobbling. They gave way altogether in the next moment, as a huge bat-like shape swooped down a foot in front of me, landing on the cobbles with a substantial thud.
"Well, well, look who's dropped in," I said,
and started to laugh in an unhinged sort of way. A large pair of hands grabbed me by the shoulders and administered a good shake.
"Be quiet, Sassnach," said Jamie, blue eyes gleaming black and dangerous in the lantern light.
He straightened up, the folds of his blue velvet cloak falling back over his shoulders as he stretched his arm toward the roof from which he had jumped. He could just grasp the edge of it, standing on his toes.
"Well, come down, then," he said impatiently, looking up. "Put your feet over the edge onto my shoulders, and you can slide down my back."
With a grating of loose roof slates, a small black figure wriggled its way cautiously backward, then swarmed down the tall figure like a monkey on a stick.
"Good man, Fergus."
Jamie clapped the boy casually on the shoulder, and even in the dim light I could see the glow of pleasure that rose in his cheeks. Jamie surveyed the landscape with a tactician's eye, and with a muttered word sent the lad down the alley to keep watch for approaching gendarmes. The essentials taken care of, he squatted down before me once more.
"Are you all right, Sassnach?"
he inquired.
"Nice of you to ask," I said politely. "Yes, thanks."
"She's not so well, though."
I waved vaguely in Mary's direction. She was still rolled into a ball, shuddering and quaking like a jelly, oozing away from Alex's fumbling efforts to pat her. Jamie spared no more than a glance at her.
So I see. Where in hell is Myrtle?
Over there, I answered. Help me up. I staggered over to the gutter where the sack that held Myrtle was heaving to and fro like an agitated caterpillar, emitting a startling mixture of muffled profanities in three languages. Jamie drew his dirk, and with what seemed to be a rather callous disregard for the contents, slit the sack from end to end. Myrtle popped out of the opening like a jack out of its box. Half his spiky black hair was pasted to his head by whatever noisome liquid the bag had rested in. The rest stood on end, lending a fiercer cast to a face rendered already sufficiently warlike by a large purple knot on the forehead and a rapidly darkening eye.
"Who hit me?" he barked.
"Well, it wasn't me," answered Jamie, raising one eyebrow. "Come along, man, we haven't got all night."
"This is never going to work," I muttered, stabbing pins decorated with brilliance at random through my hair. "She ought to have medical care, for one thing. She needs a doctor."
"She has one,"
Jamie pointed out, lifting his chin and peering down his nose into the mirror as he tied his stock.
"You."
Stock tied, he grabbed a comb and pulled it hurriedly through the thick, ruddy waves of his hair.
"No time to braid it," he muttered,
holding a thick tail behind his head as he rummaged in a drawer.
"Have you a bit of ribbon, Sassenach?"
"Let me..." I moved swiftly behind him, folding under the ends of the hair and wrapping the club in a length of green ribbon. Of all the bloody nights to have a dinner party on. And not just any dinner party, either. The Duke of Sandringham was to be guest of honour, with a small but select party to greet him. Monsieur Duvigny was coming, with his eldest son, a prominent banker. Louise and Jules de la Tour were coming, and the d'Arbonville. Just to make things interesting, the Comte Saint-Germain had also been invited. "Saint-Germain?" I had said in astonishment, when Jamie had told me the week before. "Whatever for?"
"I do business with the man," Jamie had pointed out. "He's been to dinner here before with Jared. But what I want is to have the opportunity of watching him talk to you over dinner. From what I've seen of him in business, he's not the man to hide his thoughts."
He picked up the white crystal that Master Raymond had given me and weighed it thoughtfully in his palm.
"That's pretty enough," he had said. "I'll have it set in a gold mounting so you can wear it about your neck. Toy with it at dinner until someone asks you about it, Sassenach. Then tell them what it's for, and make sure to watch Saint-Germain's face when you do. If it was him gave you the poison at Versailles, I think we'll see some sign of it."
What I wanted at the moment was peace, quiet, and total privacy in which to shake like a rabbit. What I had was a dinner party with a duke who might be a Jacobite or an English agent, a comte who might be a poisoner, and a rape victim hidden upstairs. My hand shook so that I couldn't fasten the chain that held the mounted crystal. Jamie stepped behind me and snicked the catch with one flick of his thumb. "Haven't you got any nerves?" I demanded of him. He grimaced at me in the mirror and put his hands over his stomach.
"Aye, I have. But it takes me in the belly, not the hands. Have you some of that stuff for cramp?"
"Over there." I waved at the medicine box on the table, left open from my dosing of Mary. "The little green bottle, one spoonful." Ignoring the spoon, he tilted the bottle and took several healthy gulps. He lowered it and squinted at the liquid within.
"God, that's foul stuff. Are you nearly ready, Sassenach? The guests'll be here any minute."
Mary was concealed, for the moment, in a spare room on the second floor. I had checked her carefully for injuries, which seemed limited to bruises and shock, then dosed her quickly with as large a slug of poppy syrup as seemed feasible. Alex Randall had resisted all Jamie's attempts to send him home, and instead had been left to stand guard over Mary, with strict instructions to fetch me if she woke. How on earth did that idiot happen to be there? I asked, scrabbling in the drawer for a box of powder.
I asked him that, Jamie replied. Seems the poor fool's in love with Mary Hawkins. He's been following her to and fro about the town, drooping like a wilted flower because he knows she's to wed Marigny.
I dropped the box of powder.
He's in love with her?
I wheezed, waving away the cloud of floating particles.
So he says. And I see no reason to doubt it, Jamie said, brushing powder briskly off the bosom of my dress. He was a bit distraught when he told me.
I should imagine so.
To the conflicting welter of emotions that filled me, I now added pity for Alex Randall. Of course he wouldn't have spoken to Mary, thinking the devotion of an impoverished secretary nothing compared to the wealth and position of a match with the House of Gascogne. And now what must he feel, seeing her subjected to brutal attack virtually under his nose?
Why in hell didn't he speak up? She would have run off with him in a moment.
For the pale English curate, of course, must be the spiritual object of Mary's speechless devotion.
"Randall's a gentleman," Jamie replied, handing me a feather and the pot of rouge. "You mean he's a silly ass," I said uncharitably.
Jamie's lip twitched.
"Well, perhaps," he agreed. "He's also a poor one. He hasn't the income to support a wife, should her family cast her off, which they certainly would if she eloped with him. And his health is feeble. He'd find it hard to find another position, for the Duke would certainly dismiss him without a character."
"One of the servants is bound to find her," I said, returning to an earlier worry in order to avoid thinking about this latest manifestation of tragedy.
"No, they won't. They'll all be busy serving. And by the morning she may be recovered enough to go back to her uncle's house. I sent round a note," he added, "to tell them she was staying the night with a friend as it was late. Didn't want them searching for her."
"Yes, but..."
"Sassenach."
His hands on my shoulders stopped me, and he peered over my shoulder to meet my eyes in the mirror.
"We cannot let her be seen by anyone until she's able to speak and to act as usual. Let it be known what's happened to her, and her reputation will be ruined entirely."
"Her reputation?"
"It's hardly her fault she was raped."
My voice shook slightly, and his grip on my shoulders tightened.
"It isna right, Sassenach, but it's how it is. Let it be known that she's a maid no more, and no man will take her. She'll be disgraced and live a spinster to the end of her days."
His hand squeezed my shoulder, left it, and returned to help guide a pin into the precariously anchored hair.
"It's all we can do for her, Claire," he said. "Keep her from harm, heal her as best we can, and find the filthy bastards who did it."
He turned away and groped in my casket for his stick pin.
"Christ," he added softly, speaking into the green velvet lining. "Do you think I don't know what it is to her? Or to him?"
I laid my hand on his groping fingers and squeezed. He squeezed back, then lifted my hand and kissed it briefly.
"Lord Sassenach, your fingers are cold as snow."
He turned me around to look earnestly into my face.
"Are you all right, lass?"
Whatever he saw in my face made him mutter, "Christ," again, sink to his knees, and pull me against his ruffled shirt front. I gave up the pretense of courage and clung to him, burying my face in the starchy warmth.
"Oh, God, Jamie, I was so scared. I am so scared. Oh, God, I wish you could make love to me now."
His chest vibrated under my cheek with his laugh, but he hugged me closer.
"You think that would help?"
"Yes."
In fact, I thought that I wouldn't feel safe again until I lay in the security of our bed, with the sheltering silence of the house all about us, feeling the strength and the heat of him around and within me, buttressing my courage with the joy of our joining, wiping out the horror of helplessness and near rape with the sureness of mutual possession. He held my face between his hands and kissed me, and for a moment
the fear of the future and the terror of the night fell away. Then he drew back and smiled. I could see his own worry etched in the lines of his face, but there was nothing in his eyes but the small reflection of my face.
"On account, then,"
he said softly.
We had reached the second course without incident, and I was beginning to relax slightly, though my hands still had a tendency to tremble over the consommé.
"How perfectly fascinating," I said, in response to a story of the younger Monsieur Duvernay's, to which I wasn't listening, my ears being tuned for any suspicious noises above stairs. "Do tell me more."
I caught Magnus's eye as he served the Comte Saint-Germain, seated across from me, and beamed congratulations at him, as well as I could with a mouthful of fish. Too well trained to smile in public, he inclined his head a respectful quarter inch and went on with the service. My hand went to the crystal at my neck, and I stroked it ostentatiously as the Comte, with no sign of perturbation on his saturnine features, dug into the trout with almonds. Jamie and the elder Duvernay were close in conversation at the other end of the table, food ignored as Jamie scribbled left-handed figures on a scrap of paper with a stub of chalk. "Chess or business?" I wondered. As guest of honour, the Duke sat at the centre of the table. He had enjoyed the first courses with the gusto of a natural-born trencherman, and was now engaged in animated conversation with Madame d'Arbonville on his right. As the Duke was the most obviously prominent Englishman in Paris at the time, Jamie had thought it worthwhile cultivating his acquaintance in hopes of uncovering any rumours that might lead to the sender of the musical message to Charles Stuart. My attention, though, kept straying from the Duke to the gentleman seated across from him, Silas Hawkins. I had thought I might just die on the spot and save trouble all round, when the Duke had walked through the door, gesturing casually over his shoulder and saying, "I say, Mrs. Fraser, you do know Hawkins here, don't you?" The Duke's small, merry blue eyes had met mine with a look of guileless confidence that his whims would be accommodated, and I had had no choice but to smile and nod, and tell Magnus to be sure another place was set. Jamie, seeing Mr. Hawkins as he came through the door of the drawing-room, had looked as though he were in need of another dose of stomach medicine, but had pulled himself together enough to extend a hand to Mr. Hawkins and start a conversation about the quality of the inns on the road to Calais. I glanced at the carriage clock over the mantelpiece. How long before they would all be gone? I mentally tallied the courses already served and those to come, nearly to the sweet course. Then the salad and cheese. Brandy and coffee, port for the men, liqueurs for the ladies. An hour or two for stimulating conversation. Not too stimulating, please God, or they would linger till dawn. Now they were talking of the menace of street gangs. I abandoned the fish and picked up a roll.
"And I have heard that some of these roving bands are composed not of rabble, as you would expect, but some of them younger members of the nobility."
General d'Arbonville puffed out his lips at the monstrousness of the idea.
"They do it for sport. Sport! As though the robbery of decent men and the outraging of ladies were nothing more than a cockfight."
"How extraordinary," said the Duke, with the indifference of a man who never went anywhere without a substantial escort. The platter of savouries hovered near his chin, and he scooped half a dozen onto his plate. Jamie glanced at me and rose from the table.
"If you'll excuse me, mesdames, messieurs," he said with a bow, "I have something rather special in the way of port that I would like to have His Grace taste. I'll fetch it from the cellar." "It must be the Belle Rouge," said Jules de la Tour, licking his lips in anticipation. "You have a rare treat in store, Your Grace. I've never tasted such a wine anywhere else."
"Ah, well, you soon will, Monsieur le Prince," the Comte Saint-Germain broke in. "Something even better."
"Surely there's nothing better than Belle Rouge," General d'Arbonville exclaimed.
"Yes, there is," the Comte declared, looking smug. "I have found a new port, made and bottled on the island of Gostos, off the coast of Portugal.
a colour rich as rubies, and a flavour that makes Belle Rouge taste like coloured water. I have a contract for delivery of the entire vintage in August.
Indeed, Monsieur le Comte.
Silas Hawkins raised thick, greying brows toward our end of the table.
Have you found a new partner for investment, then? I understood that your own resources were depleted, shall we say, following the sad destruction of the Patagonia.
He took a cheese savoury from the plate and popped it delicately into his mouth.
The Comte's jaw muscles bulged, and a sudden chill descended on our end of the table. From Mr. Hawkins' sidelong glance at me, and the tiny smile that lurked about his busily chewing mouth, it was clear that he knew all about my role in the destruction of the unfortunate Patagonia.
My hand went again to the crystal at my neck, but the Comte didn't look at me.
A hot flush had risen from his lacy stock, and he glared at Mr. Hawkins with open dislike.
Jamie was right. Not a man to hide his emotions.
"Fortunately, monsieur," he said, mastering his collar with an apparent effort, "I have found a partner who wishes to invest in this venture. A fellow countryman, in fact, of our gracious host."
He nodded sardonically toward the doorway, where Jamie had just appeared, followed by Magnus, who bore an enormous decanter of the Belle Rouge port. Hawkins stopped chewing for a moment, his mouth unattractively open with interest.
"A Scotsman? Who? I didn't think there were any Scots in the wine business in Paris, beside the House of Fraser."
A definite gleam of amusement lit the Comte's eyes as he glanced from Mr. Hawkins to Jamie.
"I suppose it is debatable whether the investor in question could be considered Scottish at the moment. Nonetheless, he is Milor Brochtour's fellow countryman. Charles Stuart is his name."
This bit of news had all the impact the Comte might have hoped for. Silas Hawkins sat bolt upright with an exclamation that made him choke on the remnants of his mouthful. Jamie, who had been about to speak, closed his mouth and sat down, regarding the Comte thoughtfully. Jules de la Tour began to spray exclamations and globules of spit, and both d'Arbonville made ejaculations of amazement. Even the Duke took his eyes off his plate and blinked at the Comte in interest.
"Really?" he said. "I understood the Stuarts were poor as church mice. You're sure he's not gulling you?"
"I have no wish to cast aspersions or arouse suspicions," chipped in Jules de la Tour. "But it is well known at court that the Stuarts have no money. It is true that several of the Jacobite supporters have been seeking funds lately, but without luck, so far as I have heard."
"That's true," interjected the younger Duveny, leaning forward with interest. "Charles Stuart himself has spoken privately with two bankers of my acquaintance, but no one is willing to advance him any substantial sum in his present circumstances."
I shot a quick glance at Jamie, who answered with an almost imperceptible nod. This came under the heading of good news. But then, what about the Comte's story of an investment?
"It is true," he said belligerently. "His Highness has secured a loan of 50,000 livres from an Italian bank, and has placed the entire sum at my disposal to be used in commissioning a ship and purchasing the bottling of the Gostos vineyard. I have the signed letter right here."
He tapped the breast of his coat with satisfaction, then sat back and looked triumphantly around the table, stopping at Jamie.
"Well, milor," he said, with a wave at the decanter that sat on the white cloth in front of Jamie. "Are you going to allow us to taste this famous wine?"
"Yes, of course," Jamie murmured. He reached mechanically for the first glass. Louise, who had sat quietly eating through most of the dinner, noted Jamie's discomfort. A kind friend, she turned to me in an obvious effort to change the course of the conversation to a neutral topic.
"That is a beautiful stone you wear about your neck, ma chère," she said, gesturing at my crystal. "Where did you get it?"
"Oh, this," I said. "Well, in fact..." I was interrupted by a piercing scream. It stopped all conversation, and the brittle echoes of it chimed in the crystals of the chandelier overhead.
"Mon Dieu," said the Comte Saint-Germain into the silence. "What?"
The scream was repeated, and then repeated again. The noise spilled down the wide stairway and into the foyer. The guests, rising from the dinner table like a covey of flushed quail, also spilled into the foyer, in time to see Mary Hawkins, clad in the shredded remnants of her shift, lurch into view at the top of the stair. There she stood, as though for maximum effect, mouth stretched wide, hands splayed across her bosom, where the ripped fabric all too clearly displayed the bruises left by grappling hands on her breasts and arms. Her pupils shrunk to pinpoints in the light of the candelabra. Her eyes seemed blank pools in which horror was reflected. She looked down, but plainly saw neither stairway nor crowd of gaping onlookers.
"No," she shrieked, "no! Let me go. Please, I beg you, don't touch me!"
Blinded by the drug as she was, apparently she sensed some movement behind her, for she turned and flailed wildly, hands clawing at the figure of Alex Randall, who was trying vainly to get hold of her, to calm her. Unfortunately, from below, his attempts looked rather like those of a rejected seducer bent on further attack.
"Nom de Dieu!" burst out General d'Arbonville. "Racaille! Let her go at once!"
The old soldier leapt for the stair with an agility belying his years, hand reaching instinctively for his sword, which, luckily, he had laid aside at the door. I hastily thrust myself and my voluminous skirts in front of the Comte and the younger Duveny, who showed symptoms of following the General to the rescue. But I could do nothing about Mary's uncle, Silas Hawkins. Eyes popping from his head, the wine merchant stood stunned for a moment, then lowered his head and charged like a bull, forcing his way through the onlookers. I looked wildly about for Jamie, and found him on the edge of the crowd. I caught his eye and raised my brows in silent question. In any case, nothing I said could have been heard above the hubbub in the foyer, punctuated by Mary's steam-whistle shrieks from above. Jamie shrugged at me, then glanced around him. I saw his eyes light for a moment on a three-legged table near the wall, holding a tall vase of chrysanthemums. He glanced up, measuring the distance, closed his eyes briefly as though commending his soul to God, then moved with decision. He sprang from the floor to the table, grasped the banister railing, and vaulted over it onto the stairway a few feet in advance of the General. It was such an acrobatic feat that one or two ladies gasped, little cries of admiration intermingled with their exclamations of horror. The exclamations grew louder as Jamie bounded up the remaining stairs, elbowed his way between Mary and Alex, and seizing the latter by the shoulder, took careful aim and hit him solidly on the point of the jaw. Alex, who had been staring at his employer below in open-mouthed amazement, folded gently at the knees and crumpled into a heap, eyes still wide, but gone suddenly blank and empty as Mary's. Chapter 19. An oath is sworn. The clock on the mantelpiece had an annoyingly loud tick. It was the only sound in the house, other than the creaking of the boards, and the far-off thumps of servants working late in the kitchens below. I had had enough noise to last me some time, though, and wanted only silence to mend my frazzled nerves. I opened the clock's case and removed the counterweight, and the tick ceased at once. It had undeniably been the dinner party of the season. People not fortunate enough to have been present would be claiming for months that they had been, bolstering their case with bits of repeated gossip and distorted description. I had finally got my hands on Mary long enough to force another strong dose of poppy juice down her throat. She collapsed in a pitiful heap of blood-stained clothes, leaving me free to turn my attention to the three-sided argument going on among Jamie, the General, and Mr. Hawkins. Alex had the good sense to stay unconscious, and I arranged his limp form neatly alongside Mary's on the landing, like a couple of dead mackerel. They looked like Romeo and Juliet laid out in the public square as a reproach to their relatives, but the resemblance was lost on Mr. Hawkins. "Ruined!" he kept shrieking. "You've ruined my niece.
"'The Vicomte will never have her now. "'Filthy Scottish prick, you and your strumpet!'
"'He swung on me.
"'Whore! Procuress! "'Seducing innocent young girls into your vile clutches "'for the pleasure of bastardly scum! "'You!'
"'Jamie, with a certain long-suffering grimness, "'put a hand on Mr. Hawkins' shoulders, "'turned him about, and hit him, just under the fleshy jaw. "'Then he stood abstractedly, rubbing his abused knuckles, "'watching as the stout wine merchant's eyes rolled upward. "'Mr. Hawkins fell back against the panelling "'and slid gently down the wall into a sitting position. "'Jamie turned a cold blue gaze on General d'Arbonville, "'who, observing the fate of the fallen, "'wisely put down the wine bottle he had been waving "'and took a step back.
"'Oh, go ahead,' urged a voice behind my shoulder. "'Why stop now, Turoch? "'Hit all three of them. "'Make a clean sweep of it.'
"'The General and Jamie focused a glance of united dislike "'on the dapper form behind me.
"'Go away, Saint-Germain,' Jamie said. "'This is none of your affair.'
"'He sounded weary, but raised his voice "'in order to be heard above the uproar below. "'The shoulder seams of his coat had been split.' "'And folds of his linen shirt showed white through the rents. "'Saint-Germain's thin lips curved upward in a charming smile. "'Plainly the Comte was having the time of his life.
"'Not my affair. "'How can such happenings not be the affair of every public-spirited man?'
"'His amused gaze swept the landing, littered with bodies.
"'After all,' "'If a guest of His Majesty has so perverted the meaning of hospitality "'as to maintain a brothel in his house, is that not the—' "'No, you don't,' he said,
as Jamie took a step toward him. "'A blade gleamed suddenly in his hand, appearing as though by magic "'from the ruffled lace cascading over his wrist. "'I saw Jamie's lip curl slightly, and he shifted his shoulders "'inside the ruins of his coat, settling himself for battle.
"'Stop it at once!' said an imperious voice,
and the two Duvernays, older and younger, pushed their way onto the already overcrowded landing. Duvernay, the younger, turned and waved his arms commandingly at the herd of people on the stairs, who were sufficiently cowed by his scowl to move back a step.
"You,"
said the elder Duvernay, pointing at Saint-Germain,
"if you have any feeling of public spirit, as you suggest, you will employ yourself usefully in removing some of those below."
Saint-Germain locked eyes with the banker, but after a moment the noble shrugged, and the dagger disappeared. Saint-Germain turned without comment and made his way downstairs, pushing those before him and loudly urging them to leave. Despite his exhortations and those of Gérard, the younger Duvernay, behind him, the bulk of the dinner guests departed, brimming with scandal, only upon the arrival of the King's guard. Mr. Hawkins, recovered by this time, at once lodged a charge of kidnapping and pandering against Jamie. For a moment, I really thought Jamie was going to hit him again. His muscles bunched under the azure velvet, but then relaxed as he thought better of it. After a considerable amount of confused argument and explanation, Jamie agreed to go to the guards' headquarters in the Bastille, there, perhaps, to explain himself. Alex Randall, white-faced, sweating, and clearly having no idea what was going on, was taken too. The Duke hadn't waited to see the fate of his secretary, but had discreetly summoned his coach and left before the arrival of the guard. Whatever his diplomatic mission, being involved in a scandal wouldn't help it. Mary Hawkins, still insensible, was removed to her uncle's house, wrapped in a blanket. I had narrowly avoided being included in the round-up when Jamie flatly refused to allow it, insisting that I was in a delicate condition and could on no account be removed to a prison. At last, seeing that Jamie was more than willing to start hitting people again in order to prove his point, the guard captain relented, on condition that I agreed not to leave the city. While the thought of fleeing Paris had its attractions, I could hardly leave without Jamie, and gave my parole d'honneur with no reservations. As the group milled confusedly about the foyer, lighting lanterns and gathering hats and cloaks, I saw a Meurtre, bruised face set grimly, hovering on the outskirts of the mob. Plainly, he intended to accompany Jamie wherever he was going.